Hare Krishna. I am very grateful to be among all of you this evening. Special gratitude to my dear God brothers and God sisters assembled in all directions to bless us, to Radha Devi and Nityodita Prabhu and Chaturani Devi for opening the doors to their beautiful home for us, and to all of you for being here tonight. To Jai Krishna Prabhu for taking such immense responsibility here to serve the devotees. To Malati Devi, her grace, for inspiring us by her life of devotion. You carry water so elegantly. May I tell you the first time I ever met Malati Devi? I like to tell the story. I think he's telling that story. This was in 1971, around February or March. And I had just come down from the Himalayas, living in Gaya and various places. And I was in Mumbai, taking a course on meditation for 10 days. During this course, we were supposed to sit for 18 hours a day in one place and meditate. You didn't have to, but that was encouraged. And I was enthusiastic, so I tried to do it. And sitting in one place for 18 hours a day, when the course was over, I was enthusiastic to walk. Didn't matter where. I didn't have shoes, and I just walked block after block after block. And then I saw a big sign at a stoplight. Mumbai is very crowded. In 1971, it wasn't so crowded. Now it's 15 million people. You know, this big signs advertised a spiritual festival at a park. And the park was right just a block away from where I was standing. So I went. And it's a long story, but there was about 40,000 people, 30,000, whatever it was. And somehow that was my first meeting with Srila Prabhupada. And he invited me personally to come every morning and every evening for his classes for the next 14 days. So I went from my meditation center every morning, because the retreat was finished, and I walked over and spent the whole day with the devotees. And actually, I hadn't eaten any food in about 1.5 days. So I was hungry. And I was just turned 20 years old, so I had really enthusiastic appetite also. And I heard that they were feeding, they said this the night before, that they were going to feed free prasad, or free spiritual food that morning. So I was definitely on time. I went to Srila Prabhupada's lecture. He spoke in Hindi, which I didn't understand. But I got to sit next to him, so I was happy. And then it came to prasad, and there was probably 1,000 people lined up for this prasad. It was halava. There was a huge pot of halava, which is the most favorite traditional Indian sweet. And it was hot. The pot was smoking. The fragrance was filling this giant tent. And it was making me more enthusiastic. But the line was very long. It was probably about 40 minutes standing in line. And as I was getting closer, the fragrance was becoming more irresistible. And I finally came to the front of the line. And this devotee had a big clay cup. He was giving everyone and a big scoop. And he put a scoop about this big of halava in everyone's clay cup and give it to them. And he handed me this clay cup. And it was so warm, and the smoke was coming off it. And it was, I was really enthusiastic. It was in my hand. And suddenly, this devotee grabbed it out of my hand and said, "You're not going to eat this, are you?" And I said, "It was my intention." And he said, "No, you're not going to eat this." And then he gave it to the next person in line. And now I was out of line. And I thought I had to go back to the end. There was about 2,000 people in line by that time. So I was like that. Inside, outside, I was trying to look like I was a great sadhu yogi. I was confused. What type of hospitality is this? And then he just, the same person, he was a big person, he just took me by the hand and pulled me. He said, "Come with me." I didn't know what was going to happen. So there was a stage under this gigantic tent, and he took me backstage, and he sat me down, and there were these two, like monks, sitting there, Subal and Shamsundar, and they were just sitting there, and he made me sit next to them. And seconds later, Lalati Devi appeared, my first sight of her. This was in 1971. So she was a little younger. And she had this little baby running around next to her, Saraswati. She was this little, she ran up to me and she grabbed my hand, this little baby. And she said, "Do you know who Krishna is?" And I didn't know what was going on. I said, I didn't say anything. I just looked at her, and she had kind of blue eyes, yes? Anyway, she had very bright eyes. And she was looking up at me, like smiling. Do you know who Krishna is? And I said, who? And she said, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And she ran away. And then Malati Devi handed me a big plate of prasad. It had rice and chapatis and about three different vegetable preparations, sabjis, and it had jalebis and halwa and chutneys. And so I was very happy. And that was the first prasad that I had in the Hare Krishna society. In the hands, the loving hands of Malati Devi. And even though I was, It's my good fortune. And I actually ate it all. And then she came with seconds of everything. And thirds. And I would say, no, no, I'm a sadhu, I can't eat so much. And she said, no, no, a little more, sadhus eat a lot. It's been very nice. And then that person, Guru Dasji, came back. He's the one who took the halwa out of my hand. I said, why didn't you let me eat that? He said, it's like motor oil. I didn't understand that. I said, why are you feeding it to thousands of people? It's like motor oil. And I never got an answer to that. Personally cook for Srila Prabhupada. And Yamuna Devi, who just wrote a beautiful book. Actually, she was asked for years and years to write an autobiography. But she didn't want to write an autobiography. But because so many devotees requested her, devotees even who she loved and respected, she decided to write her memoirs of Srila Prabhupada. And she spent several years writing like this. And for those of you who knew Yamuna Devi, she was very meticulous in everything she did. Her singing was George Harrison of the Beatles. He considered her voice so divine. The first time she ever met George, what was that, Battersea Street or something like that? Where you had, yeah, that was the first time they actually had a little apartment that they lived in London. Previous to that, there were three couples and a baby. Husband and wife. It was a warehouse. But previously, they were all just living anywhere, wherever they could be. Sometimes in cardboard boxes for refrigerators, that was their rooms. In the winter, with snow all around. And eventually, they got this apart. And Shamsundar Prabhu and Mukunda Maharaj, they had met the Beatles and invited George to come for prasad. So he came, and Malati Devi, Yamuna Devi, Janaki Devi had prepared a wonderful feast of prasad for George Harrison. And when Yamuna Devi came to serve him, he told her, "Your singing is celestial. You have divine voice. I'm very moved by your devotion." And she said, "You never heard me sing. How did you ever hear me sing?" And he told. He said, "The devotees used to sing at these little clubs in London." And because the Beatles were at the peak of their career at that time, if they went anywhere in public, they would be mobbed by people. George said if he was in a restaurant, people would run in and grab his sandwich. He practically couldn't do anything. But he said he would disguise himself totally with all kinds of sunglasses and other strange costumes. And he would disguise himself to go to the kirtan to hear Yamuna Devi sing. That was how much he appreciated her voice. And he told them, "I want you to make a record." They made a record in the Apple Record Studios, where the Beatles recorded. And George produced it and played the guitar on it. Paul McCartney was doing the mixing in the control room, and Malati was playing gongs, Malati Devi. And everyone was singing. And Yamuna Devi, she sang this song called the Hare Krishna Mantra. She just... together, but you especially hear her voice. And that voice became the number one hit song in all of Europe. And after that, the Radha Krishna Temple, that was the name of their band, they became so famous. In fact, Shamsundar Prabhu is writing his book now. And he's really a researcher. He's done so much research. And he went back into the archives of all of these different newspapers and televisions. And you played on Top of the Pops. That was the number one show in all of Britain, where they would get the topmost rock and roll bands to play. And Shamsundar went to their archives and found that the Radha Krishna temples played. It was national TV. It showed around Europe, too. They played 5 times on national television.
It's in my privilege here. I learned this lady from the cake, about 72 years old, although she was, you know, 25 years old, and she was the producer of that show.
Congratulations, Malati Devi. But on one show, for those of you from this era, which some of us had to be from that era, so on one show, this is what level the Radha Krishna temple was on as far as popularity. On this national television show, the band before the Radha Krishna temple was called The Who. And the band after was Creedence Clearwater Revival. So we're actually in that level. And Malati's just there playing a Malati baby playing a gong. And little baby Saraswati's going like this. And Yamuna Devi's singing like the goddess of devotion. So she writes in her books, in this beautiful book about her memoirs, and she told her dearest friend and god sister Dina Tadarni Devi that if I leave this world, you please finish this book. And then she left. One morning, in the evening, there was a beautiful kirtan, and Yamuna Devi was singing with her best friends. And then the next morning, Dina Tadarni Devi came to wake up the deities, and she saw Yamuna Devi sitting upright with her japa mala, her chanting beads in her hands, with a totally serene look on her face. Krishna just took her so gracefully, just the way she was about to go. So then Dina Tadarni took all the many, many manuscripts that she was working on for her. And what Dina Tadarni Devi told me, that she told all these stories, but she took herself out of every story. She just talked about Prabhupada and all the other devotees, and she said, and she would say, and one devotee said like this. It was her. So her friend had to put her back in her own autobiography. That was the devotion. And she would tell me about Malati Devi's devotion. She was so deeply inspired, impressed, and enlightened by her devotion. The Prabhupada made Malati Devi his cook because in any circumstance she could make a wonderful feast. No complaints. Because Srila Prabhupada was traveling in various places in India. Sometimes they would just be on a train. Right? You're on a train, overpacked with all kinds of people. In those days, you can't imagine what an Indian train was like. And they didn't just let anybody cook there. You know, you had to, the kitchens were filthy. And they weren't Brahminical standards. And they didn't let just any person cook, but somehow or other she would get in there and she would cook a whole feast for Prabhupada. Right on time. And sometimes they were on a bus going through these pothole old village Indian roads, like old bus. And she could set up her little cooker and cook a feast for Prabhupada. Sometimes she'd be all alone. She'd have to do all the shopping, and just to get there, she'd have to cross rivers with little rowboats just to get some food to cook. And then when she'd have to get, you know, either cow dung or gas or something, and monkeys would attack her and dogs would attack her because she'd just be in the middle of a field. And this spirit of devotion. No complaint, no demands for particular facilities, just to adjust to the circumstance to please Krishna. It's a great lesson in life. Whoever we are, whether we're little swamis, or whether we're little students, or whether we're billionaires or millionaires or corporate heads or mothers, whatever our situation, material nature will always create impediments that are often beyond our control. And that's so nice, because in that situation, we have to adjust our consciousness. We can't expect the world to adjust to us, because it won't. And when it does, it's only setting us up for a big surprise when things go our way. And real happiness on a spiritual level is not in any way, shape, or form about how things go our way. Some people pray to God that things go their way. And if things really start going their way, we think, just see how God is answering my prayer. Is always in his name. When things do go our way, we should know for sure, not for long. Actual happiness is when things go completely wrong and we carry on with our enthusiasm. And we find in Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Mahabharata, Chaitanya Charitamrita, this is the lesson of the great souls. Little Prahlad, when he was being just a five-year-old child, he was being persecuted. People were trying to kill him, torture him. His greatness is how he responded. With a grateful heart, he turned to Krishna, knowing Krishna's there. Whether there's birth, whether there's death, God is there for us. To turn to Krishna. Krishna's in his name. In those difficult circumstances is what Krishna sees. Sukha dukkha, in happiness, distress, honor, dishonor, pleasure, pain, health, disease. Whatever it may be, we can be distracted by success as much as failure. One of my dear friends, his uncle is a multi-billionaire. But when things didn't go his way, how he suffered and suffered and suffered, because he's so accustomed to controlling things. But when he can't control it, there's such frustration. I know people living in shanty houses where their roof is just vegetable oil cans flattened out, and they just put them together for the roof. Have you seen those in it? Just one little room with some bamboo poles and a wife and a husband and five children in that little room. probably as big as this little corner. And there's about 10,000 other little rooms like that all over it that other people live. And they're happy people. They're actually really happy. I've seen, I've gone there, I've given kitchen to them. Because they're not trying to be controllers. As long as we think we're controlling, we have to suffer. And then we start blaming people, and we start finding excuses and criticizing. Can I tell you one little story? I was just speaking at this place at the London Business School. It was a talk called TEDx. You may have heard of that kind of thing. And this lady who was speaking after me, she was 85 years old. And she told her life story. She only had 12 minutes to tell it. Because they give you, they have like a big clock that they put in front of you. But then afterward, there was this banquet for the people who spoke, and she drove me. She had a really nice car, too. I was kind of like a hitchhiker again, and she picked me up. And she told me the rest of the story. Would you like to hear? Her father was a top lawyer in Austria, and he became a judge. And her mother was a very, very educated lady who was also professional. They lived in a very elegant part of Austria, in the capital city. And then it was inevitable that soon the Nazis were going to invade. They had already more or less conquered Austria. Her family was Jewish. And they were starting to exterminate the Jews and put people in concentration camps. So the people were helpless. They really had nowhere to go. So there was a campaign, because the only country that was really somewhat safe was England. They hadn't yet conquered England. So there was a campaign of the parents for the people of England to legally adopt their children so that they could send them to England. Because they couldn't go unless they were legally adopted. So 3,000 kids were adopted from Austria. And the parents, the girl was 5 years old. Now she's 85. But this was 80 years ago. She said she was 5 years old and her sister was 8 years old. And the parents, mother, father, they said, we're going to send you on a really nice holiday. And you're going to have a lot of fun and you're going to see so many nice places and you're going to meet really good people. And they were trying to get her really excited for this trip. And the girls were, but what about you? You're not coming with us. No, no, we're going to send you. We'll come a little later. Now there's going to be some beautiful people. Your family's going to be waiting for you. And she says, but what about you? No, we'll come a little later. But they were excited to go because they were telling about all the sights and all the nice things. Then they get to the railway station. It's the day to go. And they see 3,000 kids there and all the parents are crying pathetically. And suddenly their own mother and father just break down, crying, totally broken. And the children are brokenhearted. You know what a five-year-old child is like? She didn't know what to think. And they said, you know, we'll be there soon, just go. They put them on the train. There was like 12 adults taking care of 3,000 children on a massively overcrowded train. It went from Austria to the Liverpool station in London. And during the ride, they're just crammed in with these other children, and they didn't know any. It was the first time in their life they were separated from their parents. Then they get corralled into this big, huge room. And the little girls don't know a single word of English. And nobody there knew a single word of German. They're just calling one child at a time up. And these girls don't know what's happening. And finally, they call their name about 6 or 7 hours later. By this time, the elder sister is in total trauma. Emotionally, she had been paralyzed. She couldn't say a word. She just shut down and was just looking into the sky. And this other lady, which she was, 5-year-old one, she was just crying and crying and crying hysterically. She didn't know what was happening. They called her name, and then these two elderly people, a husband and wife, they put them in a pickup truck. They have a little back seat on it, an old truck, and they don't know any English. These poor people were the ones who adopted them. They didn't know how to pacify these children. They're either stunned or wailing, weeping. It was really a culture shock for the couple. They were simple, poor farmers. They took them to this farm way out in the middle of English countryside. They had a little old house. It was the winter. There was no heat. And they couldn't relate because they didn't know each other's language. So this is how she lived. She said for weeks she just cried day and night because she was totally confused and nobody could really explain what was going on. And finally, they kind of adjusted, and it was really difficult because from affluence to poverty, from living in a city to living in a field, nobody knows you, but they had to learn English. They had to understand, these are my new parents. They were Jewish. Their new parents were Protestant, a whole different religion they had to kind of adopt. It's very, very strange. And a few years later, the mother escaped to England. But she would, from a distance, look at her children, but never show herself. Because she loved them. Because she was homeless. She was just living in a shelter for homeless people, the mother. She had no way to feed them. She had no way to send them to school. This other family was doing that for them. This other family was giving a future that the mother couldn't. And the mother knew if they saw her, they would insist on going back with the mother. So she just looked at them from a distance and cried. This is the way they were living. But that lady, she somehow or other just saw hope and opportunity. And she ended up starting a company. And her company, She started a software company in the 1950s. And she became an entrepreneur. And her company was worth tens of millions of dollars after some time. And she's given most of that, you know, in charity to children who have different types of problems. But she said to, after she told me the story, we're driving in a car together, she said something that really hit my heart. Because at this event at the London Business School, it was all college students arranging everything. She said, I love to be with these young people. She said, I don't like to be with elder people. I like to be with these young people. And listen to what she said. She said, because they are not so jaded by life. Simple thing. But it hit me. Because I started thinking, actually, I'm really jaded by life. I didn't realize it until she just said it. What does it mean by jaded by life? When you're young, you're hopeful, you see opportunities, you can easily kind of adjust to situations and move forward. But the way the world is, whoever we are, whatever we've accomplished, this world just beats you down. Yes, it just beats you down with honor and dishonor, happiness and distress, pleasure and pain, and so many people betray us. So many people hurt each other, and we read the news, and we see what's going on all over the place, and we see what's going on right near ourselves. And the tendency is we become very cynical. We become very sarcastic. We don't become very... Our innocence, our hopefulness is lost because we're jaded by life. And it's quite a miserable state. Why most young people are not jaded by life? Because they haven't been around too long. That's all. Wait till you get older, you'll get jaded. Because the world does that. But you don't have to. We don't have to. It's a choice. What was her life? Even when she started her business, she was persecuted like anything constantly. Because she was really out of place. She was against all odds in every way. But she decided not to be jaded by life, because she decided to always be focused on the positive opportunities that will be there. And when we read Srimad Bhagavatam, we read about people like Prahlad and Dhruva, Ambarish, people who, so many reasons they could feel betrayed, they could feel cheated. So many reasons that they could feel things are just not, this is, why is God doing this to me? But they chose in those situations, I'm an eternal soul. Beyond all this, Krishna, you're my shelter forever. And I'm grateful for that shelter. Where there's gratitude, there cannot be cynicism. Where there's gratitude, there's hope. Gratitude in the ultimate of all hopes, which is within us, forever, and all around us. It's Krishna's grace, Radha's grace. If we tune into that grace, there's infinite hope in our life. There's infinite reason to move forward. There's infinite reason to spread completely positive spiritual energy everywhere. And even when Srila Prabhupada would speak about the miseries of material existence, he would speak about them not just to make us depressed about the miseries of material existence, but to give an impetus. Yes, there is something beyond this. This is a reality. Let's face the reality. Because it's really depressing when you're really thinking that this material existence is so good and then it isn't. See it for what it is. It's a place where everything's always changing. And look for the spiritual essence with it. I just read a beautiful verse from Bhagavad Gita. And Srila Prabhupada explains what is Krishna consciousness. He says, in simple words, Krishna consciousness is to see that everything is Brahman. Because everything is coming from the Parabrahma. Everything is coming from Krishna. Therefore, everything that exists is spiritual. And when we forget that the purpose and the goal of everything is to reconnect with Krishna through our love, through our to connect with Krishna's love, and we try to exploit, control, and enjoy things separate from our true spiritual identity, then there's a cloud. This cloud of illusion blocks our ability to see the beauty of everything that exists because it's Krishna's. When I was in Detroit, I told a simple story. It's a story that's in The Journey Home, this book that I wrote, of when I was sitting on the bank of the confluence of the river Ganges, Yamuna, and Saraswati. The place is called Prayag. It's considered by, in the Ramayana, Lord Rama said it is the king of all holy places. The river Ganges is flowing, and I went on a third class train for free. Very crowded. No ticket collectors could get in. That's why it's free. And when I got out, I had no shoes, so I was barefoot. The sand was like fire. And I was told, you just go down the Yamuna bank and you will reach a place where the Saraswati comes up and the Yamuna comes. So I was walking, so hot the sand, because it was the summertime. It was May, the hottest time of the year. And the Indians used to say, during the British regime, only mad dogs and Englishmen go out in the noonday summer sun. Well, I guess I was an Englishman, so I guess I was like a mad dog. But I was walking, and it was really hot, and it was scorching my feet. And when I got to this incredible holy place where these three rivers meet, because it was so hot, there was no one around. I was the only one. So I sat to meditate. And I was thinking, I'm going to go in the rivers. And just then there was a hawk. Gigantic hawk. He had wide wingspan. His feathers were brown and white and gold. And he was going in circles, coming lower and lower and lower until he was just maybe about 10 feet above my head. And I looked up because he looked hungry. And as far as I could see, I was the only edible thing around because it was just sand and water. looked up at him, and the first thing I saw were his claws. They were, to me, they looked gigantic and razor sharp. They were, and they looked poised to attack something. They were like this. And he was coming lower. Then I looked a little closer and I saw his beak. He had a very curved, pointed beak that looked like he was ready to rip someone apart. And then I looked a little closer into his eyes. He had yellow eyes. And these yellow eyes were fixed in total concentration on someone. And it appeared to be me. He was gazing. Suddenly, he dove down right into the river, just in front of where I was sitting, because I was in a river bank. And he went underwater. I was like shocked. And then it was all this, he was underwater and he was splashing and splashing and splashing, and some sort of skirmish was happening. And about 20 seconds later, he came out from the water in his sharp claws. Was a fish. Now, this was just about as far away as Vrindavan Prabhu is from me now. That's where it was happening. I was watching. And I looked at that fish. Can I tell you about him? He was about a foot long. And he was flapping desperately for his life. And I could see the fish's eyes. The fish was in total disorientation and bewilderment. And the hawk just flew higher and higher and then flew away into a forest. And the whole while I was just watching, and the fish was flapping, 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 flapping desperately, but couldn't get out. I was thinking, that little fish was probably going about his life just like any other day. Swimming upstream, swimming downstream, swimming across stream. Probably with his friends, maybe his family members, and they're just, you know, looking for some food and eating some food and playing in the rocks and you know, going through the seaweed, and they're just going about their life like every other day. And at the least expected moment, he was just ripped out of the life he knew. And it was a very common kind of event to see. We see these things all the time if we're just conscious of it. But I was reflecting, what am I supposed to learn? Like that little fish, we all go about our life in our routine ways. But we don't know. At any moment, the yellow-eyed hawk of fate could rip us out of our routines. We read about it in newspapers or on internet. We hear about it. We've seen it's happened to our friends and relatives. Sometimes it's even happened to us. But still, we remain so complacent. The Srimad Bhagavatam tells Padam Padam Yadvi Padam Natesha, that there's danger at every step for anyone, whoever we are, whatever our situation. I heard a story about a man who was considered, this is a few decades ago, he was considered one of the healthiest people on the planet clinically. And he was giving seminars about how to be in perfect health by one's diet and exercise. He had a whole regime for it. And after giving a talk in California somewhere, he was walking back to his car and he slipped and broke his head and died. He was only like in his 40s. I know people in their 90s who've been smoking cigars and drinking stuff. And we just don't know, whatever arrangements we make. Certainly we have to try our best to do the best, but it should be on the basis of values, on the basis of true ideals that we're living for. Because at any moment, whoever we are, that hawk of fate can change things. But the best lesson I learned was if that fish was swimming deeper, the hawk could not reach it. If we go deeper into our own spiritual understanding, into our own Krishna consciousness, if we actually begin to taste the sweetness of the holy names of the Lord, if we actually take shelter, then whatever may come on this physical level, it cannot touch the quality of our life. I often remember when I was with His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Swami Maharaj in Gita Nagari. He was dying of cancer. He's a saint. But still, the body goes through what it goes through. But what makes him a saint? There's a saying that whether you believe in God or don't believe in God, you're still going to die. So what's the difference? But there's a difference. There's a difference of what's happening inside. It's not that taking to a life of devotion frees the body of death. It gives one the realization of the eternal soul, which is beyond death. I was here at New Vrindavan during the Festival of Inspiration. How many of you have been to Festival of Inspiration? And I was supposed to speak on a Sunday morning. I was supposed to speak Sunday afternoon. And I got a call Saturday evening from Bhakti Tirtha Swami. He said, my doctors say I'm going to die in 3 days. I'm going to leave my body. I'd really like to see you before I leave this world. So I went to Malati Devi and Anuttama Prabhu because they're kind of the organizers. And I said, I really have to go. So they said, well, why don't you give the morning talk and then you can leave after your talk. So I did that. And at the end of my talk, I told everyone who attended that His Holiness Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj is about to leave this world. He was an African-American person from Cleveland who just came from the ghettos and became one of the most powerful authors and speakers and with such realization and love. So I told everyone where I was going. Then I got in a van and drove off. And I looked in the rearview mirror, and almost everybody in the festival was in their cars and vans, coming also. You remember that? It was probably 100 people that came. And we all drove to Gita Nagari. Should I continue the story? And there were so many different kinds of people. We all went into there was an event outside where some of us spoke and he spoke. And it was presented as these are his last words to the world, because he's going to leave within 2 days. So people were really, really, their hearts were so open. And afterward, there was a meeting in his room. It was incredible. There were people in that room that were really bitter people. People with a lot of issues that were really troubling them. People with some real faith issues. Because I knew many of them. And as he was sitting there, he was emaciated. He had tumors all over his body. He had one leg amputated. He was just sitting on his little chair, smiling and speaking. And as he was speaking, everyone was in rapt attention, weeping and crying. Everyone, even me. And he finished talking. I saw every heart totally transformed with hope, with gratitude. I came back in the room after everyone was there. I said, Maharaj, how did you do that? I've never seen that happen before. You transformed everybody in a matter of minutes. And he smiled. He said, you see how nice it is to get cancer? You could do things like this. He said, I could never do this before. He said, people never listened to me the way they listened to me before. He said, it's worth it. He said, the only reason I'm here is to serve people. If I could serve people better in this situation, it's wonderful. He was blissful. Okay. And he meant it. He said, I'm so grateful. I get to serve in such a special way. So the next morning I went to him to say goodbye. The last goodbye. And I had really a busy summer. I had lectures in colleges and lectures in companies, and I had lectures in so many places and so many temples and so many meetings. So I had to leave. And I went to say goodbye to him. And I sat next to his bed. And when I was just about to talk, he smiled. He was laying down and he said, I want to die in your arms. Stay with me. I said, as long as you're alive, I'm with you. That meant 3 days. But he lasted 8 weeks. So I was there with him for 8 weeks, and it was great. It was beautiful. What was beautiful is we made an agreement. Because we knew every day that we were going to meet together and talk and share our hearts, it would likely be the last time we were ever together. Because he could pass any day. And he said, let us speak exclusively those subjects that bring us closer together with Krishna and with Prabhupada and with our acharyas. Let us not waste a single moment on any other subject, because it's just, when you know you're going to die soon, it really doesn't matter whether that Democrats or Republicans are in power. All that really matters is, how am I connecting with Krishna's grace? So there's a beautiful story in the Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita about the great Saint Madhavendra Puri when he was on his deathbed. And he spoke a particular prayer that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said was the crest jewel of prayers. It was the prayer that Sri Radha was offering in separation from Krishna when he left for Mathura. So we began each day when we met, I'd recite that prayer and we would discuss it for hours. And it led to so many incredible stories, so many exchanges of hearts, exchanges of our hearts and of our lives for that purpose of helping each other to go deeper into our love for Krishna. We spoke about forgiveness. We spoke about determination. We spoke about letting go of so many things that just hinder our progress uselessly. We spoke about the suffering of other people in the world, the suffering of other devotees in the world, how we can make a difference for them. In our life and in our death, we spoke about Krishna's beautiful pastimes and Lord Chaitanya's pastimes and our services to Prabhupada and our gratitude. Everything was just filled with gratitude. And something happened during those 8 weeks. I got a glimpse of the spiritual world. How, to the degree, human beings could love each other if we just put our egos aside and put the love of God as our connecting purpose. It's incredible. There was such love and such trust between us because it was just about Krishna. Putting Krishna in the center. And so many experiences happened during that time. But I'm going to end with one that I love to tell. Because it so much reminded me of the lesson of that fish and the hawk. One day, the pain of his body was so strong that his entire physical form was trembling. The pain had gone to the depths of his bones and his muscles. It was so intense. And as I was speaking to him, he was sitting on a chair. I could see he couldn't focus. He never cried in pain. I never heard him complain in the pain. He was just bearing it. So when I saw he couldn't discuss anything with me, I just started chanting the mantra. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
And as I was chanting, I wasn't singing, I was just speaking the mantra, like japa out loud. And he started speaking it with me. And after a couple minutes, something incredible happened. His face blossomed into a supernatural smile. Did you ever see a supernatural smile? It was just beyond this world. Because his face is dark and his teeth are white. It was incredible smiling. He was smiling. It was practically to his ears, his lips. And his eyes glistened. And then torrents of tears of ecstasy poured from his eyes. Smiling, shaking his head. He looked like he was just the happiest person in creation. And then he took my hand and squeezed it hard. and said, it doesn't get any better than this. His body was still trembling from the pain. It didn't go away. But his consciousness was so deep. It wasn't dependent on the pain going away. It was somewhere else. He said, I wouldn't trade my place for anyone else in the world. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm tasting Krishna's name. Today I am tasting Krishna's name in such a special way. It's so sweet. I wouldn't trade this experience for anything. And he smiled and looked at me with such confidence. He said, I know where I'm going, and I'm ready to go. And he meant it. He was deep in the current of grace. That's where our real happiness is. Our real happiness is on what we find within ourselves when we can connect to Krishna's infinite love for us. And we can connect to our love for Krishna. There's nothing within the world that can disturb that if we go there. And Srila Prabhupada explains in this beautiful purport, Krishna consciousness simply means to go there. And then as we're going there, we realize how everything in this world is a divine gift if it helps us to find our eternal self. And Krishna, in his beautiful names, in his many names, is always there to give us shelter. Malati Devi is an example of just trying to please Krishna, Prabhupada, your Gurudev, our Gurudev, in any situation. The example of that lady, her name is Dame Stephanie. Do you know what a dame is? In Chicago, it means something very different when I grew up. But in England, a knight is called Sir if you're a male. And if you're a female, if you are given knighthood, only the Queen of England could give knighthood. It's the highest honor given to a civilian is knighthood. Not like day and night. It's like the knights. And a woman who gets knighthood is called a dame. So she was given this highest honor by the Queen of England. Why? Because even though when we compare our sufferings to her when she was a five-year-old child, what she went through, she just saw positive opportunities and how she flourished through every aspect of life. And if we add that spiritual connection to the eternal soul and to Krishna's love, Bhakti Tirtha Swami, his disease didn't change, but he was beyond it. We are all beyond it, because we're all eternal souls. We're all eternal lovers of God. And when we share that love for each other, we have a community. Above and beyond all the various superficial differences. Because there will always be stormers. There will always be reasons to disagree. There will always be reasons to fight. There will always be reason to be arrogant and envious toward one another. That's inevitable. If we're expecting the environment to change for us to have deep relationships, it's not going to last long. individually and collectively, we have to go beyond all this. That's what we're being called to discover as we chant the holy name. Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare.